A rabbi in Detroit has broadcast his denial of the existence of God. He has argued that he can accept only that which is scientifically verifiable, that which can be deduced from fact and observation, and that the existence of God is beyond the laboratory, beyond logic. He has put it this way: I've always been convinced that common sense and empirical reasoning are the only valid ways to discover truth. And the key word here is the adverb only, that common sense and empirical reasoning are the only valid ways to discover truth. No sane man would deny to common sense or to empirical reason all its legitimate claims. But reasonable men must deny that common sense and empirical logic alone are the keys to all truth. Actually, this claim is not at all new nor unique. It was first made 2,500 years ago by the Greek philosopher Democritus. Democritus argued that only logic, only deductive reason from experience, could be man's key to philosophy, to reason, to morality, and to faith. And since Democritus' day, his arguments have been much debated and much qualified. And so it is somewhat surprising to find a presumably well-qualified contemporary asserting these prerogatives of reason in their ancient innocence. But we know now that there are many reaches of human experience. There are many necessary judgments which we must make which are beyond the competence of common sense or of empirical reason. Poetry, for instance, brings us much closer to the truth of feeling and of love than does common sense. A great painting touches more nearly the truth of beauty, the value of aesthetics, than could any empirical reason. Myth tells us much more of the operation of the unconscious than we can discover by any form of direct observation. And science is even coming up with facts concerning probabilities, indeterminacies in nature, mutants, which we can describe after the fact, but which no amount of deductive reason can ever predict. So philosophers have long since come to the awareness that there are levels of reality which forever defy logic. And they have long since asserted, at least since the days of Kant, over 150 years ago, that man requires other keys, other methods to discover the moral truths and the aesthetic truths and the spiritual truths, all of which he requires immediately in order to guide his life successfully, in order to live with some measure of decency and dignity. In brief, our art, our literature, the quality of our moral judgments depend upon other sources of truth than common sense or empirical reason. Our fathers, for instance, discovered the truth of human brotherhood 3,000 years before it was empirically verifiable, at least 2,500 years before common sense could have looked about at a world of free men and of slaves, of many nations, of learned and of barbarian, and argue that all men are innately qualified to be human. We do not require that love be proved. We do not require that beauty be proven. None of us could show objectively just why it is that a Beethoven symphony has musical virtue. We cannot show objectively the quality and virtue of our moral judgments. Why is it that we must demand in the spiritual world a test of truth that we know we cannot demand of most other crucial areas of life? I'm afraid that as a philosopher, this young rabbi is in over his depth. Indeed, his arguments are interesting rather more because they reflect the commonplace clichés of our culture. The attitudes which are spoken again and again by those who have given religion and faith only a passing glance, nothing more. Rabbi Wein speaks in these terms. He says that one can go to a modern university and study the nature of the universe and not feel the need to assume a supreme being. And I think there are many among us who instinctively agree. And it is true up to a point. You can go to a university, study science, and not feel the need to assume a supreme being if your only purpose is to gain professional competence, if your only purpose is to master some technical know-how, if you refuse to ask certain basic questions, how is it that there is a universe out there that science can deal with? How is it that we have a mind which has the capacity to reach out into this world outside and discover meaning and order in it? How is it that we are, that we think, that we can reason? And why is it? Why are we alive? Why do we have consciousness? What is the purpose of our living? If we move beyond technical knowledge, important though that may be, and ask for that knowledge which we require in order to live, in order to be human beings, then we must make certain assumptions. Then we must wrench out of the living stuff of life certain facts, certain faith, and live by these as best we know how. It's strange that a rabbi should be expressing this kind of commonplace skepticism at this moment in time. 50 years ago, I would have understood it. But the more that we have learned about the scientific enterprise, the more science has been able to philosophize about its own structure, the more we have come to recognize the credibility of the faith enterprise. The more we have understood that science can ask and answer only certain questions within a rather narrow range, and that there are other ranges of questions, other sets of information, which we desperately require for one and only one purpose, because we are alive, because we need to go on living, because we need to know by what standards, towards what goals, we must direct our lives. We tended 50 years ago to think of God as a convenient word symbol under which we swept all that we did not yet know. God was a shrinking thing. The more the frontiers of science advanced, the more God was slimmed down. Men were rather confident 50 years ago that ultimately God would be erased, found to be unnecessary. Today we recognize that science, for all its explosive advance, has not reduced God or the competence of faith or the area of faith one scintilla. They operate at different levels. Faith explains quality, meaning, purpose, morality. Science explains that which is, how it operates. And the two move along totally different tracks. They interrelate because we assimilate them into one mind, because science changes the world in which we must live. But science has not made us more competent human beings. Science, for all of its information, has not made us more able to live with dignity, to establish a just society, to create beauty. We must turn to other areas of the human mind, other relationships to the universe, to faith, to God. Now, many are surprised that a rabbi should lose his faith, if indeed he ever had it. I add this latter clause not to be at all snide, but because Rabbi Wein has written an explanation, an apologia for his personal confession, in which he says that this theological change of his is more apparent than real, in which he gives the indication that he has lived with doubt most of his adult life. If this be so, one can only wonder what he had in mind as he rose day by day in his seminary chapel to recite, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one." But be that as it may, we ought not to be surprised that a man of faith can lose his faith. We are not at all surprised when a man of no faith finds faith being born within him. We live in a confusing world. Each of us is confidently being buffeted about by a thousand cruelties, by the unexpected. Some of us react to tragedy by having our faith shattered. Others come alive to faith in tragedy, and so it is with prosperity. When we are young, when we are happy in our homes, when we are confident of our talents, it is easy to accept the religion that we learn at our mother's knee. When we move off to the university, when suddenly the vast array of human knowledge comes alive to us, we wonder if our mothers really knew so much. We come to deify man rather than our mother's God. We move in life from experience to experience, from doubt to certainty, from certainty to doubt. And few there are who can walk a steady way from the cradle to the grave. For after all, faith is a search. Search for God and search for meaning. And many are the times along the way when the heavens are closed shut, when we cry out and there is no answer, when we seek and there is only confusion. No, we ought not to be surprised that a rabbi can lose his faith. And of course, he has the right to whatever faith is his at the moment, to state it, of course, to live by it. What makes this rabbi's lonely road of interest? Simply the fact that he insists that despite his loss of faith, he can continue to function as a rabbi. And that he is attempting to build with some like-minded young people a congregation dedicated to the principle, "Hear, O Israel, there is no God, our God is not." And in doing so, this rabbi has challenged our every preconception about the role of the rabbi and our every assumption about the focus of congregational life. Now, the facts, as I understand them, are these. A year ago, this young man had a congregation in Windsor, Canada. He made a number of friends in and around Detroit, and as they began to discuss things among each other, they discovered that they shared many of the same attitudes and many of the same doubts. They were all members of that restless, rootless generation, which is so eager to experiment, to break the old forms, which is impatient with the orthodoxies and with the traditions and with the forms of the past. And they decided to create a congregation which from the very beginning would be dedicated to the new, which would be up to date, modern. Rabbi Wein agreed to be their leader. And during the summer, they met and they wrote original services. No prayer book for them. They would be the source of creativity. They created new ceremonies and new rituals. They searched out, they tinkered, they engineered. But even so, they were not satisfied. They felt still stranger, alien, and awkward when they came into the sanctuary. And they decided that this was because of the word God. Prayers to God, use of deity in Jewish theology. And the answer, it's simple. Scissor God out of the worship. Take God out of the sanctuary. And so they created a service which consisted of ethical and philosophic readings, some of them drawn from our own literature, but carefully chosen to be theologically unembarrassing, to represent the best and some of the wisest of human thought, but all of it agnostic, atheist, denying. And the rabbi presumably spoke to them of public matters, of the latest published works, things of general academic and political interest. And finally, late last fall, this man himself declared publicly his denial of God. Now, this group of people and this spiritual leader have the right, of course, to their own convictions. They are decent, honorable people. They are seeking to work out some form of group spirituality, which will be meaningful to them. There are many other such cutaway groups floating on the seas of life, seeking some meaning in a chaotic world. Our hearts go out to them. What is disturbing is that they insist that they are operating within the Jewish tradition. What is disturbing is that this rabbi insists that his atheism can be justified within our Jewish tradition. Now, actually, the way that these young people walk is not quite as novel, as new, and as dangerous as they would have us believe. 75 years ago, New York City, another group of young Jewish couples decided that they too were ill at ease with God, that they had lost their faith, and they created a community dedicated to the highest ethical reach of man. They created a service which consisted of readings very similar to that which are being chosen by this Detroit group. Interestingly, the first leader of the Ethical Culture Society was himself by training a rabbi. But he had the good sense never to call himself by this title in this new function of his. And this group had the good sense to walk aside. They were pioneering. They would create their own. They made no attempt to justify ethical culture as a Jewish entity. It represented their aspirations, not the traditional teachings of our people. The way to an ethical humanism is a well-trod way in the 20th century. One in two in America belongs to no church, no synagogue. And many privately or publicly have found their way to some kind of ethical vision which is independent of any theological substructure. How then shall we explain this group's adamant assertion that they are a synagogue and this rabbi's adamant assertion that he is functioning as a rabbi? I confess that as I read their pronouncements and hear of their activity, I find myself feeling like Alice, way down there in the topsy-turvy of Wonderland. Now, there are some who ask me, What's to be done about it? How can we read them out? How can we defrock the man? There is no way of stripping a man of his ordination. Ordination in Jewish life is simply a statement of a man's accomplishment academically. He has mastered certain areas of Jewish thought. He is declared by his seminary or by his teachers to be proficient, to teach them originally it was proficient to judge in their terms. Jewish life has always left the question of rabbinic authority to the good sense of a congregation and to the sense of honor of the man. If a congregation found that its leader was unbalanced, erratic, it found ways to relieve itself of his authority. And if the man found that he could no longer function within the terms of which the community had set out, he walked aside and he found some other undertaking and occupation in life. And this process has worked remarkably well through the ages. What's to be done? There are some who have rushed into print urging that we publicize the existence of this group and that they are not a Jewish group. I doubt that this would be very effective. There seems no indication that they have denied what they are. Their publicity has been honest. They cannot be accused of false advertising. No one who joins them can be joining them under false pretense. And I think this concern with their existence, with reading them out, masks from us what ought to be our major concern. How shall we explain this phenomenon in Jewish life? What is brought about? Could it occur here? And if so, why? I am firmly convinced that the existence of this little group is not so much an anomaly, but rather represents almost a predictable development in Jewish life. There has been a toe in our Jewish communities these past 100 years, away from faith, away from theology, away from belief, towards a secular, towards a humanistic tradition. This congregation is an elongated and exaggerated shadow. So much else which occurs in Jewish life, and perhaps by seeing the illogical end result of so much of our own activity, we can bring ourselves up short and do something about it. Jews have come to the belief, I know not from where, that Judaism is an ethical theory, not a faith. Rabbi, I believe the Ten Commandments. That's enough, isn't it? I don't have to come. First commandment, dear friends, is I am the Lord thy God who brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. How often I hear, Rabbi, Judaism is an open-minded faith. We have no dogma, we have no doctrine. Often this comment is made to me in a specious comparison with Christianity. We have no doctrine. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. God is, and God is one. Can you imagine a Judaism without this element of faith? True it is, we do not define narrowly. Judaism is not without definition. In Jewish life, we have walked aside from the synagogue. We have created a magnificent institution in our community, social welfare agency. We have emphasized philanthropy. We have emphasized citizenship. We have emphasized social action. And many delight to call themselves Jews who are active as Jewish citizens, but have no activity as Jewish congregants. Many delight to call themselves Jews who participate in all manner of fundraising and all manner of service, The thought of praying to God, the thought of practicing the ceremonies and the customs, the thought of reading the tradition hardly crosses their mind. And I'm afraid that there are many in the pulpit who are noticing their congregations thin out whenever they announce a sermon on faith, prayer, God, speak only on the political and on the published and on the most new and most academic. And so there has been a conspiracy of silence in Jewish life about God. And so most of us have walked happily along, assuming that Jewish life continue as a culture. And we have walked along happily, assuming that Jewish life is dedicated to all that is new and all that is exciting and all that is avant-garde in our tradition. How we Jews love to be in the day after tomorrow. A manufacturer of ceremonial objects for the synagogue told me recently that he often has a quite beautiful piece of art for a synagogue altar, but that he cannot convince the congregation to buy it unless it is in the most exaggerated of modern styles. It's not even a question of beauty. It's a question of newness, of wanting to be at the forefront, ahead of things. Now, you can't be in the forefront of human thought, there and there only, if you're a Jew. Judaism ties you to 4,000 years of history. You can't love to break all the rules and be a Jew. Judaism has a 4,000-year-old discipline. You can't insist that you will believe only that which is being taught to you by the Bohemians and by the newest group of young rebels. You must believe that which is taught to you by Moses, by the prophets, by the sages. Now, we may not like that. We may wish that as Jews we could break all the bounds, start anew, but you can't. You want to break the bounds, you're unhappy with the past, walk aside. Strike out and find your own way. That's a quite legitimate spiritual enterprise. But let's not, in the process, distort, pervert, destroy that which is meaningful, and I think quintessential for modern man, the venerable traditions of our faith. Now we can poke great fun at the practices of this congregation in Detroit. Rabbi Wein, their young leader, says that Judaism is a broad culture and that he has simply chosen to express his rational and humanistic philosophy through the traditional ceremonies of that culture. And as I read this gobbledygook, I asked myself, what tradition do I know that expresses a humanistic and a wholly rational attitude towards life? What could I choose? If I say grace, did I not say, Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam, hamotzi lechem min haaretz? Praised art thou, O Lord our God, King of the universe, who has brought forth the food out of the earth. And if I speak my memory and love to those whom I have lost, how do I express any humanistic teaching when I say Yiskadal v'Yiskadash Merabah, exalted and magnified be God's name? And what is humanistic about our marriage covenant when we join the young man and the young woman at the altar and together they say Hare at mekudeshet li betaba'at zu kedat Moshe v'Yisrael. Be thou consecrated unto me by this ring according to the religion of Moses and of Israel. I'm afraid that the only thing which is humanistic in our tradition is this rabbi's desire to read humanism into it. But let's not spend our time deriding and mocking. There's no profit in it. What we must ask is, how much of this is there in our Jewish life? How strong is the toll within the Jewish community, pulling us away from these roots of faith, leading us towards an atheistic Judaism, that contradiction in terms over there? How strong is it? I am convinced that many a public platform of our secular Jewish institutions, many a publication of these very same institutions will within the next month or two come out with articles lauding this young rabbi to the sky and saying, this is what we've needed all along. A clean sweep. The baby's gone out with a bath, but the sweep is clean. Emphasizing the need to dust away historical cobwebs, to break the old forms, that Judaism is not reaching out to the mass, that we must cater to that which is of the majority. I don't know how many old cobwebs are left in Jewish minds. I doubt that there's that much learning left in most. We may not be reaching the majority of Jews. Religion today generally is not reaching the majority of moderns. But does that mean that we can change the essential teachings? Does that mean that if we firmly believe and are firmly convinced that it is wholly modern, wholly creditable to believe, if we call ourselves rabbis and Jews, that we can arbitrarily pervert, distort, push aside? I'm afraid that all of this testifies only to the rampant ignorance, the thoughtlessness with which our Jewish community has approached the questions of faith. Faith is meaningless because it has been superficial, because it has not been modern, because it seemed not to be in tune for almost a century with the new, the academic, the scientific. We pushed thoughts of faith aside, and we dealt with it in the most innocent and childish and juvenile of manner. You see it here in this rabbi's apologia. He says, for instance, that he cannot believe in a conscious person in the heavens. Now, I, in all of my years, in all of my reading, I have never found a creditable Jewish source which speaks of a conscious person in the heavens. Judaism does not teach us to believe in some cosmic grandfather way up there, in a heavenly Santa Claus. Ein lo demut haguf, eino guf. God has no shape which is human, recognizable, nor is he of the substance such as we know matter to be. El mi tadamuniel, to whom will you liken God? I am afraid that this rabbi and so many who argue against God in these terms argue against their naive understanding of the Christian tradition. Christianity speaks of a son of God. There is in the Christian myth a human element. Let's not discount it. Christianity pervades our thought. We jump off from there. Judaism is discredited because this Jew cannot believe in Christianity. What folly. And he goes on to say, if you do not argue the existence of a conscious being, then men tend to argue that there is some creative force, some spiritual force imprinted in the universe, and I, this young man, cannot believe in these words because they are too nebulous to be useful to me. Now, where in all of his readings in our tradition has he found the statement that God must be useful to man? I had thought it rather the reverse, that man must be useful to God. that our lives must be dedicated to God's service. I'm afraid that he's looking for the miracle, for the faith healing, for that immediate answer to our whimperings, to all that is superstitious in all popular faith. This I hardly would expect of a rabbi. But how is it that a man alive in this century, knowing what he knows of science and the scientific discipline and the structure of the academic world, how can any man alive in this century not see the spiritual imprint in the universe? Can he not feel in himself? And is he himself not part of the universe? What we need, dear friends, is sobriety, patience, some learning. Stand ye in the way and see which is the good way, it is the old way. Walk therein, for therein shalt thou find peace of mind. Now, I like to feel up on things. I like to feel that I understand this world in which I live. I hate to be called an obscurantist. I know the psychological pressures on each of us to keep up with our children, the new learning. I know that we live in a world where the popular cliche has tended to reduce faith to a set of Christmas superstitions, pie in the sky, irrelevancy. But I know also that these years of awareness of my own tradition, our tradition, have taught me a vision and a morality and a philosophy which I believe be the only morality and philosophy which can save modern man in his present peril. I find a steadying in my faith. I find an encouragement in my faith. I find a respect for human dignity in my faith. I find a respect for the wisdom of the past in my faith. And God save the civilization which cuts itself off from the wisdom of the past. I find a spiritual comfort in my faith. And I find that my faith in no way denies any claim by science, which is legitimate, can be proven. The restlessness, the noise, the turbulence of our age is bound to create a restlessness and a rootlessness in all of us. Some will seek their salvation by breaking away. God speed them to a safe port. For me, I trust for you. We will find our guidance and our way. By reaching back to the ancient and elemental affirmations of our faith, by weaving these into the fabric of our lives, by making these guides and guideposts, and I think we will, in so doing, find a philosophy sufficient, a morality of quality, and a faith which is exciting, powerful, urgent. And I pray that our Jewish community may learn the lesson of this first distortion, and may see in the existence of this congregation the exaggerated mirror image which is our own. And if we are shocked by it, as shocked I think we must be, then let us look within and ask ourselves, how have we created this? Amen.